Well, good morning, everybody. Yeah. I bet 90% of y'all come in within 3 minutes of one another. About 10:32. Seems like took the last minute, we're not going to have anybody, and then all of a sudden, here we are. See an outline laying around, grab hold of it, and I hope you'll follow along with us this morning. We're going to be in Exodus chapter 14. We'll be covering the whole chapter this morning, 31 verses. So, going to make a little headway going through the book. You see, I've entitled the message, Stand Still. So, I want you to think just a moment. Give me a little feedback. What are some common ways that you hear or have heard someone say those two words? No other words, just stand still. Fix when you fix to get a spanking? Okay. Stand still and listen. You're adding a couple words. What are the circumstances around your words? Your mother used to tell you that for what reason?
Stand still and listen.
Okay. Say something important. Oh, okay. If you get your picture made. When you're combing your daughter's hair. Okay. Combing your daughter's hair and it's all snaggly, she won't be still. Think of something else? Okay. Some danger close by. Tying a kid's shoe, that's a good one. All right. When the kids are not paying attention and someone is to try and talk to them. All right. I thought of several, and I didn't think of hardly any of y'all's that you mentioned, hardly except Susan's. I remember getting a spanking a few times when I was a kid. Usually a mistaken identity. But we lived close to my grandparents, and my mother, probably none of you except Susan knew her in her younger days, but she was barely 5 foot tall, and she didn't look big. She wasn't big, but she probably weighed 120 or 30 pounds, but she's just dense and tough. And occasionally she would whip me, and she'd get a switch and hold, you know, one hand with my hand. She was right hand, so it'd probably be like this. But she'd hold this hand and switch my legs or my butt or whatever. And what would I do? Stand still? No. No, and my grandpa usually would come over, if he saw it, he'd make a point to come over, you know, hours later or the day or two later, whatever, and he'd have to mention it, you know. And, you know, he'd say, well, what'd I see you talking to me? You know, what'd I see you out dancing around the yard like this for, you know? And, you know, I'd kind of glare at him, shoot my eyes at him, and of course that's what he was really after, was to pester me and aggravate me. But he said it looked like me and my mother were dancing, you know, just going around in circles. And she'd be saying, stand still. Or I thought of getting a splinter out of a kid's finger. You know, you can have your kid have a splinter in his finger and he's not going to tell you, right? And it'll be red and festering, you know, look like, and you feel like you need to get it out, and no, you know, they don't want any part of it. You know, it's not hurting. You know, I just want to leave it there. You know, you say, you want your finger to rot off? Yeah, I don't care. You know, just leave it. Don't bother it. But standing still, it's hard for sometimes in certain circumstances for us to do that. And why is that? Why do we are not, certain circumstances are not willing to stand still? Because there is something that is either causing us pain or is causing us fear, and we are urgently trying to get rid of it. We're urgently trying to fix this problem, whatever it may be. Now that quick response and relationship between the need to stand still or the command to stand still and that whatever the issue is with us is sort of what we're going to be, the idea there is what we're going to be looking at today in our text. Exodus chapter 14, let's read our text. You know the children of Israel have left Egypt. God is leading them along south, along the western side of the Red Sea. All right, we saw last week they're not taking the traditional route up to Canaan, which would be northeast, probably more east than north to start with. But there, God's leading them a different direction, going southeast, more south than east. And we talked about a little of the reason why John did last week. So we're going to pick up the story in Exodus 14, verse 1. Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel that they turn and camp before Pahahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, opposite Baal Zephon. You shall camp before it by the sea. For Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, they are bewildered by the land, and the wilderness has closed them in. Then I will harden Pharaoh's heart so that he will pursue them. And I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his army, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord." Have we heard that phrase before? That the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord. I don't know how many times we have heard that. I should have went back and counted them, but I bet it's a dozen at least. Probably from the time Moses was at the burning bush in the wilderness until now, God has reiterated and clarified and said, "This is why I'm doing what I'm doing, that the Egyptians may know that I'm God." And they did so. That means this were the end of verse 4. So they did so. The Israelites camped where he told them to camp. Now it was told the king of Egypt, verse 5, that the people had fled. And the heart of Pharaoh and his servants was turned against the people, and they said, "Why have we done this, that we have let Israel go from serving us?" So he made ready his chariot and took his people with him. Also he took 600 choice chariots, and all the chariots of Egypt with captains over every one of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the children of Israel, and the children of Israel went out with boldness. So the Egyptians pursued them, all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his army, and overtook them camping by the sea beside Pahahiroth before Baal Zephon. And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. Then they said to Moses, "Because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt so with us to bring us out of Egypt? Is this not the word which we told you in Egypt, saying, 'Let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians'? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness." And Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see again no more forever. The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace." And the Lord said to Moses, "Why do you cry to me? Tell the children of Israel to go forward, but lift up your rod and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it. And the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea. And I indeed will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, and they shall follow them. So I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his army, his chariots, and his horsemen. Then the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord, when I have gained honor for myself over Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen. And the angel of God, who went before the camp of Israel, moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud went from before them and stood behind them. So it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel. Thus it was a cloud and darkness to the one, and it gave light by night to the other, so that the one did not come near the other all that night. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night, and made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. So the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on the dry ground, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. And the Egyptians pursued and went after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. And it came to pass in the morning watch that the Lord looked down upon the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and cloud, and he troubled the army of the Egyptians. And he took off their chariot wheels, so that they drove them with difficulty. And the Egyptians said, "Let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea, that the waters may come back up on the Egyptians, on their chariots and on their horsemen." And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea. When the morning appeared, the sea returned to its full depth, while the Egyptians were fleeing into it. So the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. Then the waters returned and covered the chariots, the horsemen, and all the army of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them. Not so much as one of them remained. But the children of Israel had walked on dry land in the midst of the sea, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. So the Lord saved Israel that day out of the hand of the Egyptians. And Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Thus Israel saw the great work which the Lord had done in Egypt. So the people feared the Lord and believed the Lord and his servant Moses. In this chapter, we see a story that you have, if you've been around Christianity and Christian churches, Sunday school, you probably heard the story, you've heard this account. I want to recap, just in my own words, the events that happened that we just read. I want you to see if in your growing up and in your experience of hearing this story told, that all of these elements of what I'm recapping were present in the account you were taught. Everybody understand the instructions there? Okay, so God is leading the Israelites out of Egypt. Instead of going the most convenient path to Canaan, he turns them to the right and to the south. And they go south. And it, to some extent, and in some way, they are, it appears like, the way he's leading them, it appears like that they are not really sure where they're going. And God tells them to camp in this certain spot. And in this certain spot, it appears like that they are boxed in. It appears like they've come upon a place where, as far as they know, they can't cross the Red Sea. And it looks like if someone were coming after them, they would have them trapped. And apparently, there are people around, and I'm not meaning in their midst, but there are other travelers, or there are spies from Egypt, or there's someone occasionally around that is friendly to the Pharaoh in Egypt. And he kind of notices what's going on and the way they're behaving and the way they're traveling. And he sees where they're headed, and it looks like that they are could easily be defeated or fought. And so somehow Pharaoh finds out. He lets Pharaoh know. Somehow word gets to Pharaoh. Pharaoh may have even sent him to follow. Who knows? Pharaoh knows. And Pharaoh sees the circumstances. And he thinks to himself, why in the world, what were we thinking when we let these people go? Now, I don't know how much time has passed, but surely Monday came and the workday started and there was no slave labor to make their bricks or whatever. Somebody's having to do this that is not accustomed to doing it. And already they seem to get over their, fear is a word, but their grief of losing their firstborn and all of the things with the other plagues, that has become a distant memory. And now they think, what have we done? Why did we let them go? And so Pharaoh gets his army, gets his chariots, and chases after them. It looks like, from what he has heard, that it's easy pickings. So he goes after them. And he comes close enough to them that the Israelites find out that he's pursuing them, and they see their predicament, and so they became afraid. They said, what in the world are we doing? They asked Moses, what have you led us out here for? We're fixing to be killed. We're fixing to be slaughtered. We're fixing to be captured and carried back, and things are going to be worse than they ever were. And Moses tells them, be still. Calm down. Pay attention. God will deliver you. And this cloud that had been leading them, God moves it behind them. And it comes between them and the Egyptians. And I don't know how this worked, but in some way it was there. And in some way it prevented, it made an obstacle that the Egyptians could not penetrate. It caused the Egyptians to stop and to pause. And it gave the Israelites who were on the other side an opportunity for a little reprieve, if nothing else. And in that time span, God tells Moses, hold your rod out or your hand out over the Red Sea. And God, all that night, apparently it was nighttime, the Egyptians are experiencing darkness and they can't see what's going on. On the other side of the cloud, it gives them light. They can see what's going on. Don't ask me how naturally to explain that. I don't think you can. Okay, it's a work of God. And all that night, our text says that God sent a strong east wind. And the wind blew back the waters of the sea and divided the waters. All right, I've seen all kinds of Bible story books. And they have photos or drawings of how this perhaps looked. You've seen them? How tall were those walls of water in your drawings? The ones I saw were, 20, 30, 40 foot tall. I mean, it depends on the artist, I suppose. But really tall over here, really tall over here, and here are these people, long stream of them going across. Okay? I think that that's a pretty accurate, if I read this text, that's how I would draw it if I were an artist, right? It seems that way. It says it's a wall on their right hand, a wall on their left hand. They're going across. Well, at the appropriate time, God, I don't know if he removes the cloud or what he does, but he lets the Egyptians see what is happening. They're going across on dry ground, it says. So the Egyptians take off after them. And at the appropriate time, God tells Moses, stretch your hand back over the sea, and the sea begins to close in. The sea it's just like a tsunami, I suppose. Could be back and forth as the water goes back and forth, and it covers, drowns the Egyptians. The text says not one of them remain. And the Israelites are on the other side watching. Surely they were watching. And they saw what had happened, and they rejoiced, and they believed God. They believed what Moses was saying as coming from God, and they were delivered. Now, in all of that recap, there are a couple of things, one in particular, it'll be our first point here, that I don't ever remember picking up on when I was a kid. And this is the first point on your outline. Let me back up just a second, all right? You don't care about backup, do you? I've got something on there called the big idea. Okay, the big idea is, if I was going to say one point that this text makes for us that I want you to get out of the lesson today or the sermon today, it's this. Okay, it's one sentence. It's kind of long, but let's read it. The judgment of God upon a person or nation may, at times, spill over onto his people, causing them hardship or suffering, from which they must learn to trust and believe in God and not yield to temptations to seek relief by illegitimate means. Did you able to digest that in one reading? A long sentence. Let's read it again. The judgment of God upon a person or nation may at times spill over onto his people, causing them hardship or suffering, from which they must learn to trust God, to believe in God, and not yield to temptations to seek relief by illegitimate means. Now, if you learn or catch nothing else from the message this morning, that right there is what I want you to pick up on. Now, we could vote and see if we won't just have the rest of the sermon or just take that point and leave, but I'm afraid you'd hurt my feelings. So we won't. But here's the first point now. God appears to intentionally lead the Israelites in such a way as to embolden the Egyptians to pursue them. God appears to intentionally lead the Israelites in such a meandering way or to an end place where they appear to be trapped. God intentionally does that in order to embolden the Egyptians to pursue them. I never was taught that. And I don't know that I can say the text specifically says that. But it sure seems like it to me. He tells them where to camp, specifically where to camp. He leads them in such a way that at least it appears that they are lost or confused. Now you might say, we don't know that he led them in such a way. No, we don't. But we do know that it appeared they were confused. The text tells us that in verse 3. For Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, they are bewildered by the land, and the wilderness has closed them in. It appears to Pharaoh and the Egyptians like that they are at their wits' end and there's no way out. Now, whether God specifically led them to that, to make that appear, it doesn't say. But God certainly could have led them in a way that it appeared not that way. But he didn't. God led them in such a way that it would make them appear to be trapped and entice the Egyptians to follow them. Now, what if God had gathered all the Israelites around and said, okay, let's take a vote. on which way to go. I'm going to suggest a way to go, and you tell me what you think. I would like for us to go southeast to these three places here that I don't want to try to pronounce again. All right, let's go down there. I'm going to suggest we go down that way, and we'll kind of wander around and get in this one place where there's no way out, so that the Egyptians will come after us. So let's vote. How many votes would he get from the Israelites? None. I doubt if he would get any. But he didn't ask them to vote, did he? He didn't tell them, this is what I'm doing. But it is what happened. It did happen that way. And so his people are being led into a situation intentionally by God, by their Lord, that's going to end up causing them fear. As far as they know, they're fixing to be killed or enslaved. God intentionally puts them in that situation. Now, I've been in predicaments. Have you? I've been in predicaments that were my own making. I've been in predicaments that was somebody else's making. But it never, maybe I should say very seldom, if ever, has it ever crossed my mind that God would intentionally put me in a predicament. But I think he might. I think from what I know of God, he might just do that. Not because he wants to cause me pain. He has his own reasons. It's not because he's an angry God and he's just striking out at me or for anything like that. God has his reasons to conform me to the image of his Son. And that might include placing me in a predicament that I would not choose to be. Number two, God again hardens Pharaoh's heart, resulting in his decision to come after the Israelites. How many times have we heard it said that God hardened Pharaoh's heart? Several. How many times have we heard it said that Pharaoh hardened his own heart? Several. Okay, you remember what the little tidbit of advice that you could take or leave that I gave you weeks ago? That some people want to debate which came first, God hardening or Pharaoh hardening. It doesn't matter. All right? Let's be able to say, this is what I told you back then. When the text says Pharaoh hardened his own heart, let's say it. Pharaoh hardened his own heart. When the text says God hardened his heart, let's say it. God hardened his heart. All right, they're both true. In this case, probably the last one, at least in the narrative, the text says God said, I will harden his heart. There's two words there, and this is in verse 4. Two words that tell us intent. Two words. I will harden Pharaoh's heart so that. Doesn't that tell you intent? Why is God going to harden Pharaoh's heart? So that something. What is the something? So that he will pursue them. So that he will come after them. So that he will regret ever letting them go. And come after them to take them back. We've talked a little bit just a minute ago about all that went into this. They realize that their labor force is gone. Their slave labor is gone. It's amazing how quickly sometimes we can get over pain. pain is there and it's all we can focus on, and then suddenly it's gone, and 3 days later we're ready to do the very same thing that caused the pain to start with. At least I am. Text says Pharaoh has chariots, 600 choice chariots, and even other chariots besides that. Pharaoh, from what I have understanding and reading, that the Egyptians were on the cutting edge of military technology. They had a feared army. And it doesn't take them long to get caught up with the Israelites. Number three, the Israelites don't see the, quote, big picture. They don't know. We just talked about it. They don't know what God is doing. They haven't talked to God about what is happening here. All they see is the approaching trouble. They see it and they are afraid. Instantly, they are afraid. And then they go to playing what we call the blame game. Whose fault is it? First says they cry out to the Lord, but the Lord they see is represented by who? By Moses. And so they cry out to Moses. And I like, shows you my weird sense of humor, but I get a kick, I guess I could say. I would do the same thing, I'm sure, at what they say. They're smart alecks, aren't they? Even in their fear, they got a sharp tongue. And they say, Moses, could you not find enough graves in Egypt to bury us all? There's not enough places in Egypt to bury us, so you bring us out here in the wilderness? Sound like something I'd say. It does, though. Didn't we tell you this while we were in Egypt? Just leave us alone and let us serve the Egyptians? Don't bother us. You're just causing us grief. And here we are again. You talked us into coming out here and following you, and now we're in a predicament that we will never get out of. Do you do that? No, I don't do that. When I find myself in a tight spot, when I find myself suffering, when I find myself hurting, it seems like all I am consumed with is these two words. If only. If only I hadn't done this. If only I hadn't done that. But more often than not, it's not that. It's if only you hadn't done this. If only you hadn't done that. I'm the victim. I wonder how it would change my thinking if I could see the big picture. If I could see what 5 years from now I could look back and see it at that time. Perhaps I would be more afraid. Or perhaps it wouldn't be so troubling after all. Perhaps I could trust. I don't know. And I notice also here their defeated spirit. They would have rather been a slave who was being horribly mistreated for the rest of their life than to be where they're at right now. Beat down. Defeated. Point number four. This is the only bright spot in the whole thing. Point four is this: the salvation of the Lord is a glorious thing. Let's read these texts, verses 13. And Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you will see again no more forever. The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace," or you will just be quiet. "You'll stand in speechless wonder at the salvation God brings you." Moses sounds really positive, doesn't he? Y'all into positive people and negative people? I'm not usually I read bad motives into people who talk like that, but Moses is on top of the world. He talks like he believes this. He's just saying, listen, God's going to deliver you. But I noticed something else in verse 15. And this is my supposition. You can kind of may not believe it. But verse 15, the Lord said to Moses, "Why do you cry to me?" And it makes me wonder if to the people, Moses may be putting up a front. But he gets over alone with God behind the trees or wherever. He says, "God, help us." He is worried. He is fearful himself. He cries out to God, "God, what are we going to do?" Maybe he puts on a good face to the Israelite people. But alone, his fear comes out. His own fear, his own troubled heart and spirit. And God goes on, and God, we see what God tells him to do. These verses, I like those words. Stand still. I've been in situations that were, you know, it's one thing when it's my own fault. It's one thing when I get in a predicament that's my own making. You know, I hate that bad enough. But I've been in situations before where it seemed like it was not me. It was not any of my affair. And I find myself in a troubling situation. And I find myself, I'll have to tell you, some of you already know, but I have spent hours at work, driving down the road. I've spent hours in thought, trying to figure out a way to fix pain, to fix heartache, to fix suffering. And you don't know how illegitimate plans I tried to figure out. When you have to figure out a way to fix things in such a way that you don't get caught, that's a good sign it's not the right way. I have spent hours trying to figure out a way to get not myself, but people I love out of situations in ways that I know were not right. The pain at the moment seems so great that I did my best to justify it. But somehow, God taught me, is teaching me, there are some things I cannot fix. I cannot fix. There are some things with my kids. There are some things with my grandkids. There are a lot of things with my kids and my grandkids that I cannot fix. I cannot order their lives. Only God can do those things. Only God can give them righteous desires. Only God can do all of these things, some of them that are deeply troubling. Stand still. Sit down. Be quiet. Then the last one. Sometimes it is too late to turn and avoid disaster. Sometimes we find ourselves in a predicament. This one's a little tough. And we know what's ahead. We know consequences are coming. And golly, we're sorry, right? We want to turn. Okay, now, this point that I'm making here is not talking about salvation. Okay? If anyone wants to turn, no matter how deep you're in the gutter, no matter how troubled your life is, if you want to turn to God and ask God to save you, not from deliverance from your stuff here, ask God to save you because you know you need salvation. You know that you're a sinner. And you turn to God. It is never too late to turn. God is always there. All right? But we're not talking about the salvation side of this. We're talking about consequences. We're talking about living. Sometimes you find yourself in a situation and, man, you wish you could get out. But you're not. That's where the Egyptians are here. They're in the midst of this sea, and suddenly, and I don't know how this happens, but suddenly somehow God begins to mess with their chariots. The wheels are coming off. The things aren't working right. There's confusion. Maybe they're trying to go different directions. I don't know what all it is, but the one thing is obvious. Whatever it is that God is doing to them in the midst of this two walls of water, whatever it is He's doing, He's messing with them pretty bad. And whatever it is, one thing they know, God is fighting for the Israelites. Let's get out of here. A little late. You're a little late to figure that out. They were a little late to change their mind, because God kills them. God overwhelms them with the closing in of the sea and destroys them. Why does God do it? He tells us why. So that they may know I'm God. I will be honored upon Pharaoh. I will be honored upon the Egyptian army. How is it that God got honor on them? By destroying them. By killing them. By wiping them out. Now, one last point that's a little bit off to the side here. Over the years, and I say this because you may have already seen this or you may encounter it, there are going to always be people who have a different explanation. All right? And the primary one that I have heard is that this really wasn't crossing the Red Sea. The waters didn't really, you know, go out and go across. This is up at the northern end of the Gulf of Suez, and just kind of a swampy place, all right? And they went across there, okay? I could read this chapter that we just read every day for the rest of my life, and I would never come to that picture from reading that text. Never. So why is it that someone wants to suggest that? What motivates them to suggest that? Unbelief. Unbelief. A hatred for God is what motivates them to come up with these things. Now, how do I know? So you might say, or somebody might say, well, how do you know it was? Well, because look at what it says. The water was like walls to them on each side. If I'm walking across something and the water is pulled back and it's about this tall, I wouldn't call that a wall of water, would I? And to get the Egyptians to drown in it, you know, we'd have to talk them into laying down on your face, you know. Get down there as low as you can. There's not much water here. No. People come up with those ideas because they want to disbelieve. And they do. So, let's apply this very quickly. When you find yourself in your life with things that happen, how do you typically respond? I have plans. I'm not a big plan maker, but you know, I can always kind of look back and say, yeah, I guess I was planning something. It's not something I write down. I don't write down goals and all this kind of stuff. Perhaps it's a weakness of mine. I don't know, but I can look back and kind of see, and in my mind, somewhere back there, you know, I had things that I was kind of working toward. I have plans. And the things that I kind of have plans for, I think they're legitimate. I don't know of any plans I have that are evil. I think the plans I have are God-honoring. I don't have plans that would displease God, I don't think. It may not be what He wants me to do, but it's not sin. It's not evil. And I have plans. You have plans for your life. You want your kids to grow up. You want to pay your house off. You want to do this. You want to do that. None of those things are bad. And then suddenly, some people do some things. Y'all heard that before? Let me say it my way. Some idiot does something stupid. Okay? And it touches my plans. So what do? I get angry. You know what I call my, I don't say angry, I don't get angry, I get frustrated. But really, I'm angry. Okay? I get upset because my plans have been disrupted. The money that I might have spent on a new wood lathe has now got to go to something. And that's aggravating. So what do? I don't know. Ain't that a great answer? I don't know. Here's the thing that the only thing I'm stuck with. I do what I can, or I want to do. I think it would be good to do what we can to change things. What we can legitimately do to change things. And the rest, stand still. Say, God, it is yours. It's yours. I'll do what I can without forcing the issue. You know what I mean? Forcing the issue. And the rest, we leave in God's hands. That's easier said than done. I'm not telling you this because I have achieved, not by any stretch of the imagination. That's where we're at. Let's honor God when those things happen in our lives. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your word. Thank you for the examples. God, thank you for the examples not of chaos, but the examples of deliverance. God, it encourages me. It strengthens my faith that I may suffer and die at the hands of some ungodly person. But one thing I know, you are still God. You are still my Lord. God, I reaffirm in my heart and in my head that I am yours. All the wood, hay, and stubble that I hold on so tightly to are yours. And God, I want to please you by my interactions and my reactions when those things come. God, burn this upon our minds. Burn it and etch it upon our hearts. God, give us grace to live it. Amen.